From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. Well, in the first part of the show, we enter into the world of garlic mustard and trout-friendly landscapes. That's right, with ecologist Sarah Jo Dickens. Ecology Bridge, that's her company, is hosting its second annual Garlic Mustard Games. And this year, along with weed pulling, there will be prizes and a fruit truck party. Why not? Last year, over 2,000 pounds of garlic mustard were pulled from the ground in the Park City area. We'll learn more in the first part of the show.
That's right. And then in the second half of the show, we'll keep that local outdoor landscape theme going. And we'll be speaking with Dr. Kelly Cope. She is a professor and extension specialist in the Plants, Soils, and Climates Department at Utah State University, where her research efforts focus on landscape water conservation and sustainable turfgrass management. She serves on the board of directors of USU's Center for Water Efficient Landscaping and is a board member and past president of the Utah Water Conservation Forum. Today, we'll speak with her about her research, about the work that she's doing locally, and what resources are available to our community during this upcoming, potentially very dry summer.
Right. We all need that term. Is that turfgrass management?
Yeah.
Turfgrass education.
Absolutely.
Man, that's what we're going to get this hour. Environmental awareness and education. That's what this Green Earth is all about.
Joining us this morning in the studio is Sarah Jo Dickens. She is the principal ecologist and founder of her company, Ecology Bridge. And she's here to talk with us today about some of the local efforts that are going on to help make our landscapes sustainable. Sarah, thanks for joining us so much this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So we have kind of two things we want to talk about with you today. One of those is trout-friendly landscapes. So explain to our listeners how a landscape can be friendly for fish.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange concept, right? We're not putting fish in the front yard. We're not asking you to put ponds in your front yard. But we are trying to help people understand that what you do in your backyard really does impact our waterways, all of our local waterways, and that, of course, then impacts our trout and other aquatic species, but also terrestrial species as well. So anybody that's using that water is being impacted by very simple decisions that you make every day in your landscape.
I love that link between our landscapes and the streams and the fish. As somebody who, of course, works in sort of wetlands and, you know, land management and stream restoration, that's something that I think isn't on many of our minds day to day. Like what you put on the lawn, you know, does that really have an impact beyond your lawn? It's probably fine, you know, but it really does, right? It works its way down through the watershed.
It really does. We think about stormwater. I think that's probably the easiest thing to get your head around. If you're putting chemicals on your landscape, and especially if you're putting too much, which is a pretty frequent issue, whenever it rains, that's traveling off your landscape into the road and down into the rivers. And a lot of that is, you can't see it, but it's really moving large amounts of fertilizer and pesticides and oils and things like that. So anything that we can do to reduce that amount will have a massive impact on our aquatic species.
And let's be clear, when you say chemicals, that includes fertilizer, because fertilizer is ultimately a chemical.
Definitely,
it's a mixture,
yes,
of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, other compounds that are themselves chemicals. So when people hear chemicals, they think of the classic Roundup or other types of herbicides or fungicides or insecticides. But fertilizers also are part of that equation.
Yeah, that's an important clarification. And, you know, I think that why that's so important is, you know, in the ground, nitrogen and phosphorus are great things, but in the water, when we get too much of it, that's when we start seeing those algal blooms that shut down lakes that can become toxic. So it's really important that we minimize the amount of those fertilizers reaching our natural waterways. You know, and there are ways to fertilize without using those chemicals. I mean, we all have heard of compost.
Yes, okay, go.
And so compost and things like that are natural. They break down slowly, and so they slowly feed the lawn. So rains. Maybe a little bit of nitrogen might come out of that compost, but not at all like a synthetic fertilizer would release. And so that's just a more sustainable, more thoughtful way to bring nitrogen and other fertilizer sort of compounds into your landscape.
I think that is a great topic to talk about. I think sometimes when we talk about water quality issues, we say, oh, there are tons of nutrients in the stream. And doesn't that sound like a good thing? But, you know, too much of these good things is really, really bad for that water quality. So it'll be good for us to work on this. Tell us a little bit about the Trout Friendly Lawn Program. How, what does it entail and how does one participate?
So the Trout Friendly Landscape Program actually came out of Jackson Hole in Sun Valley, Idaho, and they're both trying to address either water quantity or quality. So how much water keeps returning to our streams and what quality is that water when it's getting there. Here in Summit County, our concerns are both. So we need to be conserving water and being careful about what is getting carried with our water. And so this program is a certification program. And with a certification, a landowner gets these really cool signs. Now, Jackson Hole has the most fabulous signs, and we're...
They really are beautiful.
They're so amazing. And we're hoping that we can do something just as amazing by partnering with local artists for a competition to design that sign. But those signs then will be displayed in the landscapes of people that get certified. And we're working with USU Extension to develop that certification program. And hopefully the Master Gardener program will help us with site visits and helping people walk through the certification process and helping that get done. So it's a really good way to show off that you're making a huge difference in our local waterways by making some changes. And so those changes include reducing lawn fertilization. Maybe get your soil tested so that you know whether you need fertilizer at all, because often you really just, you don't. Mm. Or you may need iron and not nitrogen, you know? So you want to make sure you're putting the right things down, feeding what needs to be fed. Water conservation, so changing your mower blade height. And we'll learn more about that in the second half, so I'm not going to talk more about it. But using smart irrigation systems, something that shuts down when it rains. It's a lot of water that can be saved. Planting with natives, choosing something that's water-wise, drought-tolerant. Just not converting natural landscapes if you don't have to. If you've already got beautiful shrubland, you can enhance that with seeding, but there's no reason to rip it out.
Mm. That's something that I think is so common. Like when you see a new home or a renovation, you see like just an immediate sort of like a raising of everything that's on the lot. So maybe we can reconsider that too, you know?
Right. And is there a way to reduce that footprint, right? I mean, I get you got to move equipment around. It's not easy. We do landscaping as well. And that equipment ruins the grounds, right? But if we can minimize that impact, it makes a huge difference. I mean, trying to maintain something versus establishing something new just takes so much more resources, so much more water, and so much more time. It's just really best to save it to begin with.
What kind of turf grasses or so, what kind of grasses are we trying to avoid growing here?
Well, really, I think we're, you know, the typical Kentucky bluegrass.
Okay.
But I think more importantly, it's looking at a grass as a monoculture across your landscape, right?
Right.
So it's a very water-hungry species that's being grown and nothing else is being grown there and being maintained with heavy amounts of water, heavy amounts of fertilizer, and mixed in with that fertilizer is often herbicides.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So it's a monocrop.
Exactly. Yeah.
And as one, I think we had one guest describe grass as flyover country for bees and butterflies.
Oh, for sure.
Because there's nothing there for them. There's no diversity. And so there's nothing that appeals for that to them to want to
Stay.
No resources,
hey,
right?
No. So if we picture that grass, the Kentucky bluegrass, as a monocrop that is flyover country for beneficial insects and birds, et cetera, maybe we'll start to change our thinking. Plus, you say it's very water-loving. Grass, Kentucky bluegrass takes, what, half inch, three quarters of inch of water a week?
That's I don't know. I think our next speaker can tell us
okay.
that.
We'll learn more about that because that's critical because we don't get a lot of water. Surprise, a lot of rain in June, July, and August and September here. Right. So we'll talk more about that.
Yeah. And I think that pollinator part is really important.
Yes.
And in the other two locations that have this program, they talk about pollinators, but they don't specifically add it. And I'm guessing that they probably will. We're partnering with them so that we can all grow together and utilize the information and any new systems that we create so that we're not reinventing the wheel. But we're adding pollinator and wildlife friendly as one of our categories that you have to do something in order to get certified. And, you know, and that's as simple as just, you know, increasing the amount of your garden that you already have that is pollinator friendly. So choosing plants that support pollinators. And then ensuring that you have bloom the entire season. And so that's really one of the big challenges for pollinators is, you know, and when we talk about weeds, weeds are a good reason that that will happen, right? If you get weeds that come in, they take over, they're the only plant, they bloom, they last, what, 2-3 weeks, and then they die, and now you have this huge area that has nothing else blooming. So there's no longer a food source in that location. And so we're trying to increase the number of plants that they have access to the entire season.
So with the Trout Friendly Lawn Program certification, not lawn, landscape, Trout Friendly Landscape, we've expanded this. With the Trout Friendly Landscape Program, if people are interested in getting involved, what kind of, you know, level of commitment does that entail? And will they learn about that at your event next week?
Yeah, so we do have a training and it's free to the community. It will be May 16th from 5 to 8 p.m. and it's going to be held at the Richens Building in Kimball Junction, so the library building there. And we're going to go over topics that include water quality and, you know, what is the current condition for trout habitat locally? Talking about East Canyon Creek, given that this was and is an East Canyon Creek Watershed Committee project in partnership with Trout Unlimited. But we'll talk then also about soil health and turf grass, noxious weeds, how can we control them without using chemicals? When is that appropriate? Selecting plants that are drought tolerant, and then how do you get certified, right? And so that process, you get certified, you get your sign, and you just try and maintain those changes. And maybe it'll inspire you to add a little bit more next year. And we have different levels. So you can be bronze, silver, and gold. Of course, we're in Park City, so it has to be Olympic themed.
Has to be metal themed.
Exactly.
Has to be a competition.
And everyone wants gold, right? So find out. Come to the event and find out how many things you can do to improve your landscape. And on the first, the bronze, we really set it up so it costs nothing. We don't want money to be a barrier. We also have some funding to give out stipends to a few folks who want to start making these changes in their landscape. And so we're getting our website put together. So hopefully that'll be up and running. USU is going to host it for us. And you'll be able to get more information about how you can do this. Also sign up for that stipend, fill out an application, and, you know, get help from a lot of us. Next year, our hope is to launch the landscaper portion of this. So we've got to drive a need for it. So we want our residents to get excited. And then next year, when they're all like, who's going to do this for me? We want landscapers to know how important it is that they need to be able to provide these services. And so we'll have an additional amount of information for landscape companies so they can be certified in trout-friendly landscaping. But that doesn't mean it's the only thing they do. It just means that they have the capacity, they understand, and they can provide that service for you.
So they get awarded, and they get to sell that as part
totally,
of their brand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That they provide this service. Because let's be honest, there are a lot of landscaping businesses that could benefit from some education and change in behavior as far as the services they provide. Because, hey, growing grass makes money for them.
It does.
It does. Because it's got to be mowed. It's got to be fertilized. It's got to be herbicided. It's got to be trimmed. And then, of course, you have to have those ridiculous grass blowers that blow grass from point A to point B. And also pollen and bacteria and fecal matter. Don't get me started. But those things, but that's a money-making situation for them.
It is, but I think too, these other more water conservation minded practices at first can also be a little bit costly. And I think one challenge that I would put out to residents is, if you want more than somebody coming and mowing your lawn every 2 weeks, it's going to cost a little bit more, especially up front.
Yeah.
And I think that's important, because it's easier to do a quick mow and blow setup where you're running in, you're mowing, and then you're on your way, than it is to do all of the other variety of things. And it costs more to hire staff that can provide those services.
Okay.
Well, I hate to change the topic, because I think we could talk about trout-friendly landscapes a little bit longer. But we also wanted to chat with you about garlic mustard and the upcoming garlic mustard game. So let's start with the basics. What is garlic mustard and why does it matter?
Well, it's my nemesis, first off.
I'll join you in that, yeah.
I think that there are very many neighborhoods that would join me in that around this area. But it's a biennial plant, so it's a plant that only lives 2 years. That first year, it just is a little rosette, which means it's that tiny little plant on the ground that only gets a few inches tall. And then in the second year, it will flower, produce seed, and die. And that's the end of its life. And I love biennial weeds, because that means I have an opportunity to reduce the amount of chemicals I'm using, because I can pull biennials. So the Summit CWMA, which is the Cooperative Weed Management Area, it's a big partnership, local government, nonprofits, local businesses. We are coming together to try and obviously work on reducing noxious weeds throughout our county and adjacent counties. Actually, we work with Wasatch and Salt Lake and Morgan County as well. And in doing that control work, when we look at the thousands of acres that we are working on, it's not possible to control our noxious weeds completely chemically free. Logistically speaking, it's just not possible. If I had many armies and endless amounts of money, I would totally go pull it all. Mm-hmm. But as it stands with the technology we have, we just can't do that. And so one way that we can reduce the amount of herbicide that we use is to reach out to our public and ask for their assistance. And so we developed the garlic mustard games actually 3 years ago. The first year was the Armstrong Challenge, if anyone saw that along the Armstrong Trail. Mm-hmm. And that year we pulled just over 2,000 pounds. And then last year we changed it to the garlic mustard games. And every event we hold, we do raffles. We also give a prize to the number one puller of the day. And then you can enter into the whole season-long competition, and our top pulling teams will be able to attend a food truck party for free. And we'll probably partner with Comrades again. I don't know about you all, but I love that man's cooking.
Okay.
It's pretty amazing.
This is a powerful incentive
to
participate.
It is. It's so good.
Does it include garlic mustard?
You know what? He was actually thinking about making a sauce. We were joking about it. But by the time we do this event, the garlic mustard isn't any good for anything.
Well, talk about the act of pulling this. This is pulling the weed, not necessarily cutting the weed or, of course, spraying something on it to kill it. It has to be pulled.
Yeah, so we're pulling it. And the reason that we only pull second-year plants, so the ones that are going to flower or are flowering. And the reason that we do that is because it's easy, and our biggest goal is to get rid of seed production. So if we can just keep it from producing seed, then next year we're a little closer to that soil seed bank being depleted. And we want to get most of the root. And the great thing about plants when they are biennial and they're flowering is they're taking those nutrients, they're putting them in the flower, and so those roots are just a little bit weaker down there. So we can pull them out a little bit easier, because they're preparing to die. All of their energy now is going to making seed. Mm. So it's a little easier to pull them out of the ground at that point. And, you know, I should say, why do we care about garlic mustard? You know, one thing, it grows fast. It takes over fast, right? And so it replaces very important diversity of plants that support our wildlife and, like we said earlier, our pollinators, right? But in addition, it puts chemicals in the soil that inhibit germination of other plants, which is pretty important because it can last in the soil and we don't know how long. with the work that we've done here locally, we're seeing that it can take 3 years for some of our native plants to even start germinating after we've done the work. But nobody's really done a lot of research on how long these chemicals last and how much is actually put in the soil and how much does it take to really inhibit things. So it's really not well understood. The other thing that it does is it puts chemicals in the soil, or at least doesn't put something in the soil that feeds our natural microbial communities. And in doing this, it suppresses our microbes. So our bacteria and our fungi that most of our native species will rely on. And this is super important for our conifer species, especially now that we're in drought. They need that fungus to reach deeper and farther away sources of water. And if they can't have that, they're far more likely to die of drought stress. And then add beetle kill. So we're looking at what seems like a cute little plant, but when we're looking at acres and acres of it, over time, it's really stressing our plants and our trees that are already stressed. So what does that lead to? Increased chance of wildfire over time.
It's incredible the like wide-ranging, broad impact that, like you said, this cute little plant, a pretty little edible plant
that was brought in as an herb into this part
of the world. And it has these sort of cascading effects, you know, far throughout kind of our ecosystem. Can you tell people, you know, I know this is always hard on a radio show, but can you describe what it looks like, Sarah Jo?
Oh, good challenge. So the rosette actually typically has 3 to maybe 5 or 6 leaves, and the leaves are all heart-shaped or kidney bean-shaped. Mm-hmm. The leaf can feel like it's a little bit bumpy, a little bit hairy. The edges look like it has teeth. If they're really young and you pick the leaves and crush them in your fingers, it can smell like garlic. Mm-hmm. Now I'm noticing that we're not having that smell as much, and I don't know if that's because maybe they're just not as healthy, we don't have as much moisture, so maybe they're just not able to produce as much of the chemicals that give off that scent. In the second year though, as it gets taller, those leaves start to turn more arrow-shaped, and so they get a real, I guess, a distinct point at the end, but the edges of the leaf are still toothed. And then our flower, it's so sweet. It's this little cluster of white flowers with 4 petals on each flower. I would say each cluster, maybe 1 to 2 inches in diameter. So they're not huge. The little flowers themselves are like a centimeter, but the clusters can be like an inch or so in diameter. And this plant literally can get chest high if it's under a lot of trees and it's really happy.
Plenty of moisture.
Right. It's like, oh, it's moist, but it's shady. I need to keep growing. But generally, you're going to see it about knee height. So like maybe a foot or so.
And again, it actually emits or produces a chemical which, in effect, poisons the soil around it, immediately around, to prevent other plants from growing. It creates its own competition barrier in that.
Totally. It's incredible. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say it's a poison. I don't even know what we would call it, right? It's just an inhibiting chemical.
Well,
it's an allelopathy.
Another plant, it's poison to you.
Well, yeah, to that plant it feels like it's poison.
But that's
allelopathy, and that's, you know, it plants all over can produce different chemicals that can suppress either other plants or microbes or even their own plant species. You know, like the mama shrub, like a sage, can actually suppress the growth of their own seedlings underneath them. It's very common. But, you know, different species have evolved with those different chemicals in the soil. And so, you know, either you've learned to live with it or you've learned to utilize it.
Now, big problem at Swanner?
You know, it's something we've been watching really carefully, and I would call it not a big problem, but an ongoing problem on Swanner Preserve. So, you know, this is one of those weeds that first popped up, you know, I don't know, in the late 2000s, and we really started to see it around town, and it has just expanded exponentially. One of the places we often see it is, like Sarah Jo's talking about, under the forest canopy in the woods.
Right.
And because we don't have a lot of trees on the nature preserve, that makes it a little bit less of an issue. But where we do see it trying to take hold is like along the edges of our streams, like in the riparian corridors, underneath a bridge, you know, on our, like, on the trails that go around the preserve, places like that that are a little bit disturbed and they're wet and shady.
So they don't like drought.
They don't.
They prefer a wetter setting.
I would say prefer is a perfect word.
Okay.
Because they can grow in drought.
Yeah.
But so like the last couple of years, it's funny, we talk about pulling 2,000 pounds last year, and that sounds like a lot. And it was to all of you who pulled. Thank you. You're amazing. I don't want to downplay that. But what makes that even more amazing is that last year we were actually pulling rosettes. Because after 2 years of drought, we normally get this flush of fall germination. And we haven't had that in 2 years because it's been too dry for that germination to occur. And then come spring, last spring really wasn't that wet either. So we really didn't get the early germination in spring we normally have. And so we just didn't get the flowering plants for 2 years. Well, last fall, we had that early snowfall, soils were moist, we had a lot of germination. So those are the rosettes that are going to be flowers this year. Then this weird spring, that's so much moisture and then so much heat, we're having a lot more germination. I mean, we already have plants flowering. I think that this is going to be probably the biggest season for garlic mustard that we've seen in 5 years. And so that's kind of why this Garlic Mustard Games is so important, because we only have so much funding from the state and we really need as much help as possible. And it's an easy plant to pull. It's a lot of fun. And then when you weigh a bag and you're like, dude, I just pulled 40 pounds of this weed, you really feel good about yourself. Like as a group, you turn around and you're like, oh my God, I can see the ground now. And you can see other plants that you've freed from this garlic mustard attack. So, yeah.
So if people, again, we have to wrap up, and again, we could keep talking, but you know, if people want to participate or just learn more about the plant, where would you recommend that they go?
Well, they can go to the new Summit CWMA website, which is summitcwma.org. You can always follow Ecology Bridge as well on Facebook, or look me up online and you can call us. But on the Summit CWMA webpage, we do have a calendar. And so we have, it looks like, I think 12 events already organized across the Snyderville Basin area, and partnering with great partners like Woodward will be pulling up there again this year. The Glenwood Cemetery, let's support our history and keep those weeds out of our native habitat. So if you want to participate, you can go online there. You can always look up Ecology Bridge. You can always email me, Joe at Ecology Bridge, or our other person, Betsy, who is our new staff member, who is just killing it and really is in charge of the Garlic Mustard Games this year. So Betsy at ecologybridge.com.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sarah Jo. It's always great to have you in. And thanks for all the awesome work you're doing in the community.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes.
We're excited to see trout-friendly landscaping.
Yeah. Oh, me
off.
Too.
May 16th. All right.
In the studio with us is Kelly Cope. She's a professor and extension specialist at Utah State University in the Plants, Soils, and Climate Department. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have been reading a lot about the ongoing drought here in Utah and the really dry conditions that we're seeing. And so we thought that this spring would be a good time to talk to you about how to manage our landscapes, you know, our lawns, our gardens, and our community shared spaces. And we know that this is your expertise. So let's start with this. A lot of your research revolves around turf grass. Mm-hmm. How do you define turf grass?
Well, turf grass is the living, growing plant material that many of us have in our yards. It's in our parks. It's in many municipal areas. It covers a vast amount of land area in this country. It's considered actually the number one irrigated crop in this country. More than corn, more than some others as well. And it sort of straddles the line between a crop and an ornamental landscape plant. And so it's sort of a funny area of research for me because it does that.
And I always think of Kentucky bluegrass when mm-hmm. I think of turf grass, but mm-hmm. there are a lot of other types, right?
Indeed, there are many species. And even beyond that, within the species of Kentucky bluegrass, there are literally hundreds of varieties. So, you know, if you're maybe more familiar with vegetable plants, maybe you know about tomatoes, and maybe you know about Roma tomatoes or Early Girl, various other ones. Grasses are exactly the same way. There are literally hundreds of varieties.
And I'll ask you what I asked Sarah Jo, and I was told that you might be able to...
Please hold your question.
Okay.
How much water is required to grow these varieties of grass, say, on a weekly basis, just to give us a sense of how water-loving it is, or water-needy it is?
Okay, let me just pause there.
I know you're going to say it depends or something.
Well, that's the classic academic answer, right, isn't it? But it is true, in fact, in this case. So let's just talk about Kentucky bluegrass first. So while there are some varieties of Kentucky bluegrass that are higher water use, and in this climate would require approximately 24 inches of irrigation water over the whole growing season.
Okay.
There are other varieties of Kentucky bluegrass that require half that. So it really is a complicated question, and it really does depend on the variety.
Yeah, but even if it's 12 inches over the growing season, the growing mm-hmm. season is what, 4 months,
mm-hmm.
16 weeks, that's more than a half inch a week.
Indeed, yes.
And we don't get a half inch of rainfall here. We don't get...
We do
we
not.
We don't get 2 inches of rainfall during a typical June, July, or August.
That's true.
So that's why we have to supplement natural mm-hmm. rainfall mm-hmm. with irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the problem, that it's not a native. Would
no.
you say it's not a native grass?
It's not a native
okay.
grass. However, there are many native grasses that
right.
do grow here and can work in the same capacity and function. And I would add to that, you know, and I will freely admit I'm a little bit sensitive on this topic, but I would add to that many of our landscape plants require supplemental irrigation, and in fact, some of our larger trees require significantly more than that. So, you know, it's a relative thing, and when we talk about water conservation in the landscape, we often talk about prioritizing irrigation. And I'd love to touch on that today.
Okay.
Well, I have one more question I want to ask before
okay.
that.
Sure.
But that's more about the native grasses
mm-hmm.
that can also be used in landscapes. You
yes.
know, coming as an ecologist to this, I love, like, whenever we can get native plants involved, I'm on board.
Yes.
Because of the role they play, you know, with the rest of the ecosystem. So are there viable options we can use in our landscapes that are natives?
Yes, yes. In fact, there are many native bluegrasses. They're not Kentucky bluegrass, but there are many native bluegrasses that grow in the Intermountain West that are options. Another would be buffalo grass. That's another native grass to this region that can grow well here. Another, not necessarily native, but lower water use grass would be blue grama. That's another that can be used. So there's just so many options. But I think if I could back up just briefly, I want to really emphasize that when we have turf grasses in our landscapes, I am certainly not advocating for turf grass everywhere. It's not appropriate for that. But it is appropriate for areas where there's a lot of traffic, where we've got kids playing, where we have pets, things like that. And so I often describe those areas as functional turf grass areas.
Yeah. And I think that's a great conversation to have too. You know, there's a reason people love having turf grass.
Right.
It's
right.
soft. It's nice under your feet. You know,
right.
it's relatively simple to maintain. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely.
But do you find that people, once they start having this conversation, are interested in, you know, reducing the amount they have, or are people pretty tied
yes.
to their turf grass?
Well, I think we do need to be going in that direction. I think we need to be reducing, you know, I see very often landscapes that are just wall-to-wall grass. And I think
yeah.
to myself, well, I can't imagine you're using every bit of that, right? Not all of that can be functional. And so we talk a lot about having a functional amount of grass, a usable amount. If you're only walking on it to mow it, that's not functional, for example. And so,
Fair enough.
What we want are landscapes that provide that function, but then also serve other functions. I was listening into the previous interview with Sarah Jo and loved what she had to say about pollinators, you know, and anything that we can do to increase those in our landscapes, of course, is good. And by the way, I would add that turf grasses in the spring do flower, and they do provide a source of pollen for our pollinators. So, you know, they do have a lot of ecological functions, and I'd love to get into that too.
Well, I think we better dive into it because we have, you know, 17 minutes left.
Okay.
But let's talk a little bit about, you know, we have a potentially dry summer coming up. We know we're in a drought. How do we manage our watering? How can we use less or conserve water in our landscapes?
So that's where the prioritization comes in. And so within USU Extension, we're all trying to sing the same song. as it relates to landscape irrigation. And prioritization of irrigation in a landscape should be in this order. So our trees should be the top priority because our trees perform so many wonderful functions in our landscapes, including cooling, they sequester carbon, they produce oxygen like every other plant. So they're the top priority.
Habitat.
Yes, habitat,
nursery.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay.
So they're the top priority. After that, we would go to shrubs. So shrubs in the landscape, and these are the longer lived plants in the landscape, by the way. So shrubs would be next, followed by perennials. And then at the very bottom, I would put turf grasses and even annual flowers, because those plants can require a fair bit of water. And where we are facing a really serious water situation this summer, that's an area where we can really conserve.
Okay, so we start with our trees and these longer-lived species, the woody shrubs, and work our way down to the annuals. Mm-hmm. Let's also talk about the ecological role that you were mentioning. You know, how can turf grasses contribute something and not be, as Chris has taken to calling it, flyover country, you know, for our birds and our bees? Like,
right.
What can bring a value?
Right. So in the springtime, as I mentioned, they do flower, so they do provide pollen. And they also perform a number of other ecosystem functions.
Yeah.
One of those is that they do sequester carbon, and we have research to show that turf grasses actually sequester more carbon than many other landscape plants. And so they perform that function. They also produce oxygen. One of the really fantastic functions they perform, to my mind, because I have something of a water quality background, is grasses can keep storm water on site.
Mm-hmm.
And because they are so dense, they can allow that water to remain on site and infiltrate as opposed to running off. And many cities have to deal with stormwater runoff as an environmental issue. And so they really work well in that way. And that's why you'll often see them growing in retention basins, places like that, because they perform that function. In addition, when that water goes onto a turf grass area, they can take up many, many nutrients. They're very good at that because of dense root systems. So they really work to clean water. They work to retain water. They also work to cool the environment around our structures, just like every landscape plant does. So they perform many of the same positive functions that other landscape plants do.
How do we choose the right grass or grasses for our landscapes? Like in, you know, at my home, how do I decide what works best?
Well, I would always direct you to a USU County Extension office. We have offices in every county of the state. We provide that information. We also provide a lot of that information through USU's Center for Water Efficient Landscaping website. That's cwel.usu.edu. Had to think about that for just a minute.
Yep.
But we have a lot of that information available, and I do work with the Division of Water Resources in the state, as well as many of the water conservancy districts, to provide them with that information so that they can then share it out. But there is a vast amount of information, and so I'm doing the best I can to get that out there to give people information about species and varieties that work well here that we have tested and done research on.
Great.
We're speaking with Dr. Kelly Cope. She's a Utah State University professor in the Department of Plants, Soils, and Climate. And the majority of our conversation this morning is surrounding turf grass. And different varieties and different requirements. To add, you know, it's interesting you say that, that grasses, again, certain types of turf grasses, actually do a good job at sequestering carbon. But there's also a carbon requirement to manage those grasses in terms of having to, and again, I'm thinking of the classic mow that grass, mm-hmm. mow it, trim it, blow it, the energy required to water it, fertilize it, et cetera. So on the one hand, they can sequester carbon. That's good. But on the other hand, they can require carbon to manage them.
Indeed.
And so there is a balance that has to be struck there with respect to that equation, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there is a balance. And if I can just talk about for a second a little bit of research I'm doing that relates. So I am embarking on a project this very summer in which I'm looking to design, test, manage, qualify, quantify landscapes that actually provide more in terms of ecosystem services than they require. Mm. So that kind of gets to what you're talking about with the carbon involved with landscape management. And it's going to be a full life cycle analysis. So what does it cost from growing the plants, transporting the plants, installing the plants, managing the plants, all of that. So
a full footprint analysis.
Exactly.
Okay.
I'm embarking on that this summer. But you're bringing up an excellent point. So the gasoline required to run the equipment that is often used to manage these landscapes is not insignificant. And so a part of the research that I'm going to be doing will be looking at electric equipment for the purpose, right? And how that affects the overall carbon balance. Because, you know, I'm in a plant, soils, and climate department, and my goal is to have climate resilient landscapes. That's what we need right now when we're faced with a really challenging drought situation. We need landscapes that are going to be resilient.
How do we, you know, again, like if people are thinking about their own yards or a property that they manage, and maybe they don't have the resources to redo the entire thing, mm-hmm. what are some first steps people can take to work towards water conservation or climate resilience in their own space?
Well, there's some really, really simple things. And I love that you ask the question, you know, what's just a first simple step without, you know, a wholesale replacement.
Right, because
right?
it's overwhelming when you think, oh,
totally
God, there's so much I could do.
Indeed. So, you know, one of the really simple things that I like to tell folks is you can work with what you have. In the case of grasses, doing something really, really simple, like mowing it really high, like the highest your mower will go. That one practice does more for the water use efficiency of the grass than just about anything else you can do, because higher grass grows deeper roots. There is that absolute relationship. In addition, shades the soil surface. So there's less moisture loss to the atmosphere. So that's one thing. That's one first simple thing. The other
that
thing.
That seems doable.
I think so.
We can check that one off the list.
I think so. And in addition, you know, when you have higher grass, I loved, again, the conversation about pollinators. And I'm not one that wants an absolutely immaculate lawn. There are plenty of weeds, flowering weeds, I'm not too worried about. I love that. I love that diversity. So that's another thing. But another thing that I would really encourage people to do is check out UtahWaterSavers.com. That is a website that is being managed by the state, and that is where you can access rebates for things like irrigation controllers that automate the process that take weather data and irrigate accordingly. So you can get support for making that change. And in fact, you know, just that one simple change can reduce irrigation by 50%.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Now, of course, already I can hear the voices saying, oh, a longer grass is a scruffier looking grass. Huh. It's not as, like you say, is not as crisp and manicured that a lot of people prefer. But again, there's so many benefits.
Indeed.
Of growing. And again, when you say longer, are you talking about half inch longer, an inch longer? I mean, or maybe in percentages.
Yes,
longer.
I'm talking about having a look at your mower and just raising it up as high as it will go. In general, that's going to be somewhere around 3 to 4 inches. And that is a perfectly fine height. And by the way, if you mow that height consistently, it still will look very tidy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's what we want to know, right?
Yeah.
And that, and again, the savings on the carbon footprint.
Yes.
Is got to be dramatic too.
Yes.
Not just water, but the carbon footprint. Less mowing, again. It's a healthier grass, so maybe it doesn't need as much.
That's right.
Supplemental fertilizing or so?
Well,
how does that work?
It is healthier, but I'm glad you mentioned fertilization.
Yeah.
Because we have done some research at USU. In fact, we started this last summer. We tried to see how far can we push grass. Mm. And we had some plots that we literally were irrigating half an inch per month. Per month. We had other plots that we were irrigating 1 inch per month.
Okay.
And to make a long story short, what we found was that, yes, everything went dormant in the heat of the summer, as was expected. But in the fall, everything started to come back. We did a companion experiment where we added fertilization to that equation. And what we found in that case was that some amount of fertilization could be as little as 1 or 2 pounds of nitrogen over the whole growing season, really improved that recovery in the fall, even at low irrigation levels. So I guess what I would say, again, a simple thing, don't overlook fertilization, because fertilization will keep the grass healthy even through dormancy in the heat of the summer, and then in the fall, it recovers really nicely.
And how do you, you know, kind of figure out if you need to fertilize or not? Like, can you do a soil test? Are there standards that you kind of, or like rule of thumb you would advise people on?
Yeah, it really is more of a rule of thumb thing with nitrogen and turf grasses. And the reason for that is that testing nitrogen in the soil is really tricky unless you're doing production agriculture, in which case you're trying to produce a crop, right? But with grasses, you're not. And so we work more with what we have learned from years and years of copious amounts of research. And we also happen to know that our soils in Utah tend to be fairly low in nitrogen. And so that little bit of supplementation with our grasses can go a long way towards helping them deal with the drought that we are going to be facing.
What about those that say, I'm just going to tear up my grass?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to replace it with mulch and rock.
Ooh.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We have some thoughts. But
pros and cons of that.
Okay, well, one of the things I like to say to folks, now here in Summit County and here in Park City in particular, we enjoy very, very close proximity to what I would call a more natural or native landscape. And we're really lucky that way. But really, ornamental landscapes, I don't even like to call them that. They're just landscapes, and they actually, they're ecosystems. In fact, they are the ecosystems that most people interact with the most on a daily basis. And so I really like to think of them that way. And when you talk about removing plants from the landscape, whether it's turf or anything else, and going to just mulch or perhaps rock mulch, you're removing carbon sequestration capacity, you're removing oxygen production capacity. I didn't even mention the fact that grasses do also help with air pollution. Mm-hmm. I did mention water pollution. But you're removing all of those ecosystem services. And I think I would add to that, I did mention cooling around our structures that we get from plant material around our structures. And when we don't have that cooling and we have to increase air conditioning, for example, there is water embedded in the energy required for air conditioning. I don't know how many of you heard recently about what's going on with Lake Powell and the efforts to maintain the hydropower production in Lake Powell, but that's a perfect example, right? There's water embedded in that energy production. And
right.
So,
I mean, coal-fired power plants require water because all they're doing is boiling water.
Indeed.
Like that, right? That's what coal does.
So I would say, you know, maintaining plants in our landscapes, whatever your personal choice may be in that regard, is super important for maintaining those ecosystem services, for reducing those energy costs, and frankly, for improving our quality of life. We also know that there are incredible mental health benefits from having landscapes around us.
We've talked about this in other settings, really in more urban settings, the importance of having some green space or some trees and how much that can do for a community's mental health and economic. I mean, it seems to run the gamut. It does everything.
It really does magically. It really does.
Okay, so we have a couple of minutes left, about 2 minutes. So if people are feeling really jazzed now, they're psyched to make a change, tell us where you would direct them. Are there programs available and online resources, things like that?
Yes, I think I would steer folks back towards UtahWaterSavers.com in terms of rebates, but that's also where there's going to be more information coming up from the Division of Water Resources about, for example, flip your strip programs, where people are making changes to the parking strip in front of their homes. That's a big effort that's being undertaken. I would also direct them to conservewater.utah.gov.
Okay.
That is the Division of Water Resources conservation page, and they have a lot of information there to support changes. And lastly, I would say I've been directing folks, especially folks who want to maintain some amount of functional turf grass, but maybe reduce it. But I've been directing folks to tgwca.org.
Okay, that's TGWCA?
That's correct.
Okay.
And that is the Turf Grass Water Conservation Alliance, which is a national certification program that Utah State participates in. And that's where we have been able to identify these low water use bluegrasses, for example, as well as many other species. And so you can learn about where to get the seed. Unfortunately, right now, we don't have any sod sources for those in Utah at the moment, but I'm hoping that will change.
Hmm.
All right. Well, we'll work on that. And then again, the Seawell, the Center for Water Efficient Landscaping, you guys have a website as well.
Mm-hmm.
Seawell.usu.edu.
That's right.
Well, this is Dr. Kelly Cope, professor at Utah State University in the Department of Plants, Soils, and Climates. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks.
We appreciate having you.
Thank you.
A wealth of knowledge and inspiration for this dry summer. Well, it's time to wrap up.
Hey, it's time to wrap things up. Let's thank listeners like you.
You can always email us your thoughts, your comments, and your ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
And the interviews for this show will be posted on the KPCW website later today. You can also listen to the show by visiting any place you get your podcast.
That's right. Anywhere you find your podcast, we're there.
We're there?
Yeah.
We're everywhere.
Yeah. Chris, we're kind of a big deal.
We're...
I'm just kidding. I don't think anybody's
listening.
I'll take
that. Yeah. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. Tune in and listen like a local. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.